Are you aching for a love that will never leave? A presence that will push back the dark? If so, I have good news for you. God's love is relentless, even when your faith isn't. Welcome to the Relentless Podcast, a 15-episode podcast designed to give you a behind-the-scenes look at the stories and biblical history that make up the pages of Relentless, the unshakable presence of a God who never leaves. My goal here is twofold. One, to help you feel less alone. And two, and this is even more important, to help you find solid evidence of God's presence in the middle of your story. From first episode till now, I've been trying to walk you along with kind of some of the thoughts behind the different chapters, but also helping you find your 12 altar stones. I want at the end of the last page for you to have your own altar of 12 stones that testify to God's presence with you, no matter what comes. And the reason for that is because you and I both know this is not the last of the difficult things you'll deal with. Until we get to the last day of our lives, there will be more unexpected circumstances and challenging things that we will have to face. And my hope is that we shore up enough factual evidence of God's presence so that way, no matter what happens, no matter what comes, no matter how hard it may be down the road, that we will know for certain that God's love is unfailing and his presence is relentless, relentless. It's been such a huge part of my journey, and this is what I want for you. Today we are talking about chapter 10, A Meal, A God Who Is With You in Your Hunger. So I have a question for you as we begin. First of all, have you ever known what it feels like to be truly hungry? I mean truly hungry. I know there are times, my kids actually tell me on a regular basis that they're quote unquote starving. Of course, they are not starving, but they are convinced they are. But have you ever known what it feels like to be truly hungry? So completely hungry and utterly unable to fill yourself, right? So you're so hungry, but you have no ability to find food and to eat the food, and you're starving. Until I went through the last several years, my only example of being truly hungry, of knowing what that feels like, is before I would go have blood drawn at the doctor. And, you know, if you're doing like a glucose test or something like that, they say, you need to fast before your blood test. You can't have anything for breakfast, only water. And so I'd have to go like 4 whole hours without eating. And I usually thought I was going to die. Please tell me I'm not the only one. But I would, on those days, you know, I would dread it, and I'd try to time my doctor's appointment to get my lab work done at the earliest possible time in the morning so that I could go home and eat. Obviously, going without food for a few hours was not going to kill me. But in my head, I was hungry and wasn't allowed to satisfy that hunger, which is a terrible feeling. Let's just be really quite honest. I'll never forget the day that my smallest 3 children joined our family. It was July of 2011, the day before we had gotten a phone call from a relative telling us about a mom who had 3 children, twin 4-year-olds and a 5-year-old, who needed a place to live. She was no longer able to care for them, the biological mother, and so we were asked to take them in. So the next day, we borrowed some car seats and we packed them in the car and drove to another state and picked up these 3 kiddos. When we brought them home, I remember making for them a box of Kraft macaroni and cheese because, hello, what would be a better meal for a preschooler than Kraft macaroni and cheese and watermelon slices? And in my mind, it was certain to make me a hero, right? Serve up mac and cheese and watermelon. And these were tiny little 4 and 5-year-olds. They were pretty small even for their age, right? So I thought surely one box of Kraft macaroni and cheese and watermelon would be enough. Within seconds of serving it up, I'm not kidding, within seconds of serving it up, I equally divided one box between all three of them. Every last noodle was gone. There was nothing left, not a single piece of mac and cheese left. The other thing I noticed is that they swallowed it whole. They shoveled the mac and cheese into their mouths like it would run off their plate if they didn't eat it fast. And there's really only one way to describe how they eat their food. That day and the hundreds and hundreds of days that have followed, desperation. They ate with a desperation I had never seen in children before. And I had raised three boys, right? So I'm fairly accustomed to hungry teenage boys. So, and I'm fairly accustomed to children shoveling food in their mouths. But my boys never ate with that kind of desperation. They may have been hungry, but there wasn't this frightened, scared, desperate look on their face as they ate their food. What's interesting is I remember as a little girl, my dad eating the same way. I hadn't connected the dots. I hadn't understood why, but I remember how my dad would eat with that same kind of desperation, even as an adult. I mean, he was definitely a smidgen of a control freak when it came to my brother and I finishing everything on our plates. And we never could get our plates as clean as his. I mean, let me tell you, when my dad would eat his dinner, there was not a drop of anything left. I mean, he ate all of it every time, and the entire plate was clean every time. I thought that was normal. That's what I grew up seeing. I thought that was normal. I didn't realize that there are people who don't wipe their plate clean of all evidence of food. And I didn't understand that till I became an adult and was eating with other adults who sometimes left a couple pieces of food on their plate, right? But when I took in these three young children, watched how they eat, it reminded me of how my dad ate as well. There was that desperation there. And quite honestly, I didn't understand it, right? I didn't really understand why my kids, even a year or two after they had been with us, why they still ate with that desperation with my dad. I didn't understand. He was a grown adult. He had had plenty of food for his entire adult life. Why was he still eating with that kind of desperation? I didn't understand any of this until my third round of cancer, when I experienced true hunger. So to give you an idea, and I don't think I go into very much detail about this in the book, but for my cancer surgery, the big one that took out two-thirds of my tongue, I remember my last meal the night before that surgery because I wanted to have one of my favorite meals, and I talk about it in the book. You can read it in the book, what I ended up eating, but I knew, you know, with taking out two-thirds of my tongue, I would lose most of my taste, and I wanted to taste my favorite meal again. But that day, of course, I got up early in the morning, was not allowed to have food or water, which is understandable, but that was only the beginning of my hunger. After they took out my tongue, they made a graft from tissue from my left arm and blood vessels from my left arm, tissue from my neck and blood vessels from my neck, and used all of that to create sort of a semblance of a tongue. And then they had to put a Doppler ultrasound in my tongue that stayed there for 2 days to make sure that there was blood flow, because they basically wanted to create live tissue, not just like a dead scar graft, but live tissue that would function. And so it's complicated. And for you medical people, you think it's pretty cool, but the rest of you are probably grossed out right now. But long story short, I couldn't have anything by mouth, nothing in my mouth for 2 weeks. Okay, we're not talking 4 hours. This isn't a normal pre-blood draw fast. 2 weeks, I couldn't have so much as an ice chip. Not kidding. And I will never forget, I was in the ICU for a couple days after that surgery, and I can't remember. I think it was the second day. My husband came in with my kids. My mom had been staying with me in the hospital. My husband came in with a drink carrier with Starbucks lattes in it. And I'm laying there. At that point, I hadn't had even a sip of water in over 24 hours. And I also realize I've lost most of my taste and I'm missing the tongue, right? So it's a lot. And I watched my husband carry in one of my favorite drinks and hand it to my mom, knowing that I couldn't have one myself. Let me tell you, oh man. I mean, he didn't mean anything by it, but I have never felt my hunger as much as I felt my hunger in that moment. My desire for something that I could not fill. My longing for something that I could not have. So incredibly painful. And that was just the beginning. 14 days I went without any water or ice or food. I had a feeding tube in my stomach, so all fluid had to go directly into my stomach, but I couldn't have anything in my mouth or my throat. And that's not very comfortable, by the way. 14 days. When I finally went for my follow-up and they gave me the approval to have liquids, clear liquids only, I went home and all I wanted was a glass of water. I was so happy to have a glass of water. I had no idea how much we take for granted, obviously, just some of the basic parts of our sustenance. That was a horrific season. And then after that 2 weeks, I started chemotherapy and radiation. And then my throat and everything burned enough that I couldn't swallow anyway. So the rest of my nourishment for months went directly into a tube in my stomach. So those first 2 weeks were only the very beginning of what I would need to deal with. And I can honestly say now that, yes, I have experienced true hunger. True hunger that I have not been able to fill. I have a whole new awareness now. When I've done a lot of work with Compassion International, and when I talk to the alumni in the program, these men and women who were once children in just abject poverty, and they talk about not having food or water and what that felt like for year upon year upon year, I have a tiny glimpse of what that must have been like for them and how traumatic it is when we have a hunger, a physical hunger that we cannot fill. It is a horrific suffering that is most of us in Western civilization have no idea what that feels like. We have no idea what it feels like to be truly hungry. And those 6 months of me having a feeding tube and not being able to eat, I have a tiny little glimpse now of what real hunger is. The irony, however, is that our physical hunger is only the barest representation of our soul hunger. You and I carry around a soul hunger. Ever since the Garden of Eden, we have carried around a soul hunger that is starving for, is desperate for intimacy. We are desperate to be connected and filled with a love that comes from relationship. We see evidence of this everywhere. The epidemic of addictions that we have, I mean, people, the amount of and different types of addictions that we have is really quite profound. We have so many different kinds of addictions. And really, this epidemic of addictions is nothing more than a desperate need to fill a hunger that we haven't been able to fill anywhere else. And so we use these addictions to try to soothe the soul hunger that we feel. And of course, these addictions, these things we try to fill our hunger with, never work. They may satisfy for a moment and take the pain away for a moment, but it never cures our hunger. In this chapter, in chapter 10, I talk about a pretty famous experiment with Dr. Harlow and his monkeys. You can find the videos of this online. It's a little traumatic to watch what they did to these monkeys. I think it was back in the 60s, I can't remember, but long time ago, they're black and white videos. But in Harlow's experiment with the monkeys, he had different groups of baby monkeys, and some of them were fed their milk, they were fed a bottle via a cold wire apparatus. So there was this wire apparatus that would hold the bottle, and the monkey could go and drink the milk and get its hunger filled. But then he had another group of monkeys that got their nourishment with a soft terry cloth apparatus. So it was still a wire apparatus, but it had like this terry cloth around it, okay? And what would happen is that the monkeys, when they were hungry, they may go to the wire apparatus to get their food, But the monkeys spent the vast majority of their time with the terry cloth, quote unquote, mother, right? The terry cloth apparatus. In other words, and these monkeys were together, but they had these two options. Those who only had the cold wire apparatus didn't function as well because they needed more than just having their bellies full. Those monkeys were not nearly as well adjusted, nearly as happy, you could say, as the monkeys who had the terry cloth apparatus, because curing our physical hunger is never enough. We need more than just food in our bellies. We need relationship. We need warmth. We need safety. We need connection. And that ultimately is, you know, I sit there and think, how brilliant of God to create us with a need to get our stomachs full, but also using meals as a means of connection. A shared meal, we are, so much of our culture, especially in the United States, is centered around restaurants and food and meals. Probably too much so, right? But at the same time, the reason for that is because of the connection that takes place at a shared meal, at a restaurant table, at the kitchen table in your home. A shared meal is significant. And it's significant not simply because it feeds our physical hunger, but because it offers us, well, there's three different significances, let's say it that way, three different means of significance of a shared meal. The first is that it reminds us, when we sit down to a meal with another person, it reminds us of our shared humanity. Just like the monkeys in the cage, all of them needed food. All of them needed nourishment in order to survive. They needed to have the bottle of milk in order to be healthy and whole and to live. And they knew it. There was some instinctual need to fill their bellies. They felt their physical hunger. But it also reminds us of our shared humanity and our need for a relationship. Okay, without food, every one of us will die. Without each other, every one of us will emotionally shrivel. We need relationship. We're not nearly as independent as we think. And a shared meal reminds us of our shared humanity. To sit together at a table is to acknowledge that all of us need the same thing. Okay. Ultimately, we all have the same destination. Okay, this shared awareness of our mortality makes way for humility. It's to acknowledge that we are not invincible and that we actually do need something in order to survive. And then the second significance is it requires us to set aside our different agendas and come together under one purpose. A meal requires us to set aside all of the different agendas of the day and to come together for one shared purpose. A shared meal is a unifying experience, okay? It requires us to put aside all the other things we think is important to do the one thing that is important in this moment, and that's to satisfy our hunger. And then finally, the last significance here is a shared meal provides us an opportunity for reciprocity. When we come together around the table with our family, with our friends, with our coworkers, wherever it is, we must take turns eating and conversing. We go back and forth. It's like a tennis match, right? Or like the many instruments of a symphony. I talked about that in this chapter, where everybody takes a different turn at playing solo. There's multiple different instruments. Each person takes a lead at a different point in time, but it requires us to practice reciprocity, the going back and forth around a shared purpose. Now, I want you to translate all of this to the Last Supper, because the Last Supper was significant in multiple ways, far deeper ways than I could even go into in Relentless or can in this podcast. But the Last Supper, like any shared meal, had similar significance. Right. The first is that the Last Supper reminded all of the disciples and Jesus himself, because he was in the flesh, he was human, reminded us of our shared humanity. They all came together at that moment. They shared a meal. God didn't do that accidentally. It had significance. It was reminding all of us of our mortality. It was a shared humility. And Jesus was prepping for his own death, right? At this Last Supper, he was prepping for that. But there was a communal reminder that all of us are destined for death at some point in time. The food might be staving off death for a while, but eventually death is going to catch up with us. We are not as independent as we think. The Last Supper also reminded the disciples and all of us that we all think we have different agendas, right? But we came together for one purpose. And that Last Supper, it was a Passover meal. That Last Supper was reminding us of the fact that, again, we have this single purpose of we are destined for death. Yes, we have this shared humanity. But God, out of love and grace, chose to pass over judgment on us and instead preserve our life and give us a promise of new life in relationship with him. That's a singular purpose that brings us together. And then the third significance is this opportunity for reciprocity, right? Where we give and take and back and forth. But the beauty of this shared reciprocity is that Jesus went first. He entered into the death experience first. He entered into that himself first. He did it so that way we could have life. He took the cost. He paid the price so that way we could live forever. And man, it's a beautiful symbolic expression of really, truly the gospel of what it's all about. And now, because of my challenges with eating, sitting at a table is kind of a loaded bag for me. It is very hard for me to eat. It's even hard for me to talk and swallow my own spit as I speak and do this podcast. But to sit at a table and to navigate food and water and different textures and different sizes of food and all of that and to move it around and swallow it without choking is a little tiny miracle every single day. And yet, I recognize, even in my struggle to eat, my dependence, an awareness of my mortality, an awareness, an added humility of my place at this table, that I don't deserve to be here, that I have nothing to offer, and yet everything's been laid out for me. Jesus has set this table for me. He has set this table for me, and all I have to do is pull up my chair and sit with him at it. That's the beauty of the Last Supper, the beauty of the cross, that Jesus went first so that way I could sit at his table as broken as I am and I could finally get my soul hunger filled. I live a little bit hungry all the time right now because it's so hard to get food into my belly. But the truth is I've been soul hungry my whole entire life. And I am learning that there's really only one place I can go to get my hunger satisfied. And it's with Jesus himself. And when we pull up a chair at his table, whether it's me and my brokenness, my three kids and their hunger, my father and his hunger, when we pull up a chair at Jesus' table, the Last Supper table, we find a place to finally be full. Now, what does this look like for us? How do we find the presence of God in our hunger? Our hunger indicates a need that we have, but a need that we were created to have. And so when I am hungry, and when I feel my soul hunger, I'm learning to recognize it as evidence of the imprint of God in my life, that what I'm really aching for is him. I am aching for a relationship that is better than all the other relationships I've had in life. I'm aching for a relationship that's finally going to make me feel whole. And even though I don't like the feel of my hunger, it's reminded me how I was created. And that is evidence of God there. So this is what I want you to do. I want you to pay attention to your hunger, both for food, but also for a relationship. I want you to notice even the difficult emotions, the painful parts of hunger, the ones that make you feel desperate, okay? Pay attention to it. Your desperation is simply a hunger for a God who has everything that you need. What do the hard emotions, what does your hunger tell you about how you were created? What does your hunger, your desperation, your hard emotions tell you about what you need most? I want you to look for evidence of God right there in that place of hunger. As uncomfortable as it is, as desperate as it makes you feel, look at it. Learn to look at it as God drawing you and pulling you to himself. He is using your hunger to remind you that he has exactly what you need to be full. We will never be full completely until the day that we're in heaven. But for now, our hunger can indicate to us and can lead us to the one table where we will be welcomed in all of our dysfunction and brokenness, and where you and I will finally be full. And then one last follow-up action step. I want you to think how you can create tables like Jesus did. Create tables where others are welcome. How can we live the kind of life where our life itself is a table with open chairs, where people, as hungry as they are, as desperate as they may be, can find a safe place to meet Jesus there? What would it look like to make your life that kind of table? All right, that's altar stone number 10, friends. Thank you so much for doing this journey with me. Life is so much sweeter and more bearable when we don't have to do it alone. Even better, we have a God who has promised to always be with us and never stop loving us. I will not leave you as orphans. I will come to you, Jesus said. Man, it's a good promise, and I believe him. Now, that's something worth living for. Are you aching for a love that will never leave? A presence that will push back the dark? If so, I have good news for you. God's love is relentless, even when your faith isn't. And the circumstances you fear might drown your faith could become the stones giving testimony to it. Join me, and let's find evidence of him together.